It is almost 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 41 degrees under fair skies. At the airport, they are showing completely calm winds and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service says mostly sunny skies for the rest of the day, with southwest winds around 5, turning to the east sometime this afternoon. For tonight, a chance of rain and snow late, mainly after 4 a.m. Otherwise, mostly cloudy skies tonight, low of 25, west winds to 10. And for tomorrow, mostly cloudy skies, 30% chance of snow early in the morning. Sunny skies for Thursday. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Alaska House of Representatives took a step toward raising the state's age of consent to 18 years old. And the Pentagon has taken a step forward on its proposal to build a small, self-contained nuclear power plant at Eielson Air Force Base. That plus the Alaska Board of Game has rejected a proposal to bring back a wolf no-kill zone. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A nearly 950-foot container ship is now trapped beneath twisted metal where the Francis Scott Key Bridge once spanned the Patapsco River in Baltimore, Maryland. The bridge collapsed overnight. A ship called Dolly struck the bridge after issuing a Mayday call that it was experiencing power issues. At the time of the collapse, a construction crew was doing pothole repairs. Two people were rescued. One is in critical condition, but some 15 hours after the collapse, six people are still unaccounted for. Governor Wes Moore says the operation underway is still a search and rescue. Earlier, Moore described the impact of the unprecedented event across the region.
This is a place that is a normal commute route for over 30,000 Marylanders every single day. And so to hear the words that the Key Bridge has collapsed, it's shocking and heartbreaking.
The full scope of disruption to commuters in the area has yet to be realized. NPR's Laura Walmsley spoke with one man shaken by the collapse.
Joshua Ribeiro was working on a construction project in the area late last night.
And all of a sudden we heard what we thought was a tornado, but it was really a big bang, and we all went outside, but we couldn't really see anything.
Later, he found out that it was an enormous container ship hitting the bridge he drives over all the time.
Scary, because I could have been on that bridge.
The tens of thousands who use that bridge every day are just beginning to find out what this is going to mean for the foreseeable future. Ribeiro says that his drive usually takes 21 minutes.
Now I think it's going to take an hour. That's why I'm actually here, because I looked at the traffic and it says all red. So I'm just going to wait, look around, see what's going on, pray for the people.
Laurel Walmsley, NPR News, Dundalk, Maryland.
A majority of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court appeared skeptical of arguments that a medical group challenging the FDA's actions making abortion pills more accessible had standing to bring a lawsuit. NPR's Jimena Bustia reports more than abortion rights are at issue in the case.
The entire structure of the FDA's regulatory power to approve drugs and continually evaluate their safety could be in danger if the Supreme Court sides with the plaintiffs. But both conservative and liberal judges appeared skeptical that the group that brought the lawsuit, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, had standing. The group, which was founded just months after the Dobbs decision, filed a lawsuit seeking to get rid of abortion pills altogether. It contends that the FDA's loosening of restrictions is unjustified and unsafe. But after a series of lower court rulings, the Supreme Court intervened to prevent any change to the status quo while it considers the case. Siding with the FDA in this case are virtually all of the major medical associations in the country. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News.
The Dow is down 31 points at the close. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. The Pentagon may move ahead this summer on a proposal to build a small, self-contained nuclear power plant on Eielson Air Force Base. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, a senior Air Force official updated state lawmakers on the project last week.
It's been 6 months since Air Force Assistant Secretary Ravi Chowdhury announced with great fanfare in Fairbanks that the service had decided to award a contract to build and operate the first microreactor on a U.S. military installation.
I am super proud to announce the notice of intent to award selection of our first microreactor technology to Oklo Incorporated.
But a couple of weeks later, the Air Force rescinded the decision to award the contract to California-based Oklo because another company had protested. And since then, military officials have said very little about the proposal, until last week.
The notice of intent to award was then reissued in February.
That's Nancy Baucus, another Air Force Assistant Secretary, who on March 18th gave the State Senate Resources Committee an update on the microreactor project.
And then in March, a bidder then submitted a GAO protest, so that's where we stand today.
Baucus told committee members the protest filed this month with the Federal Government Accounting Office must be resolved by June 20th. She couldn't provide details about the protest, but said the Air Force remains determined to have the microreactor operational in 2028.
We believe that having documented the entire process, that the next, second, third, and fourth will take less time to implement because we will have established a path.
When questioned by committee co-chair Senator Kathy Geisel of Anchorage about the price of the reactor, Baucus said that'll be worked out after the contract is finalized.
We do not have a cost figure at this time, and that will be negotiated with the vendor once they have gotten through the design and the licensing process.
Baucus said the contractor will build and operate the facility, and the Air Force will purchase the electricity and heat that it generates. In response to committee co-chair Senator Click Bishop of Fairbanks' query about how the reactor will be refueled, she says that's also yet to be determined.
Will the entire assembly be taken back to the manufacturing plant? Will a new unit be come in with new fuel already loaded into it? We don't have that level of detail at this time.
Bishop told Baucus that he hopes there won't be any more delays because he says microreactor technology holds great promise for both reducing greenhouse gas emissions and helping Alaska solve stubborn economic problems by finding less expensive ways to generate electricity.
If we're going to be competitive and stop the out-migration and bend the curve on our GDP going the wrong direction and want to grow Alaska, we have got to have, I call it cheap energy.
Bishop said in an interview Friday that Alaska's elected leaders have taken steps in the right direction over the past couple of years with legislation that promotes development of power-generating microreactors. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Alaska Board of Game has rejected a proposal that would have brought back a wolf no-kill zone in an area of state land that juts into the northeast corner of Denali National Park. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
So-called wolf buffer zones, in effect in the area between 2000 and 2010, aimed to protect Park Road area wolves from being hunted and trapped when they crossed onto the state land along the Stampede Road. There have been regular proposals to reinstate a buffer, most recently by the National Park Service, which was considered by the Game Board during a meeting last week in Fairbanks. The Park Service has documented a decline in wolf sightings since the last buffer zone was eliminated, and Nancy Bale with the nonprofit Denali Citizens Council told the board its reestablishment could help turn that around.
We know that viewing success is related to many factors, such as den location, but nevertheless, human harvest nearby is a controllable variable.
Bale also highlighted long-running research on the wolves and noted that roughly a third of their mortality is due to human harvest, but the State Department of Fish and Game recommended the board oppose the proposal. State biologist Tony Hollis said that an average of 3 wolves per year were harvested in the area between 2018 and 2022.
The department has no biological concerns with wolf populations or harvest in this area.
Game Board Chair Jerry Burnett underscored that the panel has been over the issue numerous times for many years and downplayed the impact of reduced wolf viewing on Denali visitation.
In fact, I asked the National Park, the Denali Park superintendent last time if he thought this would make any difference to the number of people that came to the park. And he said no.
Following a very brief discussion, the board unanimously voted down the proposal, a failure the DCC's bail attributes to politics.
That emanates from our governor, that resists cooperation with federal entities and places Hunter Opportunity at the top of the heap among a variety of management criteria.
The Denali Wolf Buffer proposal was one of the last of 200 involving primarily interior and eastern Arctic hunting and trapping issues considered by the board during its March 15th through the 22nd Fairbanks meeting. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska House of Representatives took a step towards raising the state's age of consent from 16 to 18 years old on Friday. A bipartisan majority of the House approved the measure as an amendment to a bill that would require shelters and state service providers to screen minors for signs of sexual exploitation. Representative Andrew Gray, an Anchorage Democrat, put the proposal forward, saying it would bring Alaska in line with states like Florida and Arizona.
As our statutes currently stand, if a 40-year-old man engages in sex acts with a 15-year-old, there's no question that that a crime has occurred. If the same act happened and the girl was a few weeks older, suddenly the onus is on her to prove she didn't consent.
The handwritten amendment passed by the House would not, in its current form, change the age of consent in all situations. It would only change the law outlining first-degree sexual abuse of a minor, and only in situations in which the abuser is someone in a position of authority or a household member. Gray says he hopes to modify the language as the legislative process continues, raising the age of consent to 18 more broadly. State law generally exempts relationships in which the parties are within 3 or 4 years of one another. The change faced pushback from some Republicans who raised concerns over possible unintended consequences, including Homer Representative Sarah Vance, the sponsor of the original bill.
I stand in opposition to this because it's not in the appropriate place in a bill that is just simply trying to screen our children for exploitation.
Representative Jamie Allard, an Eagle River Republican, raised concerns about conflicts with other state laws allowing Alaskans to marry or be emancipated at 16 years old. The amendment passed 32-6, with Vance joining 5 other Republicans in voting no. A final vote on the bill is scheduled for the House's session today. If it passes, it would move to the Senate. A brand new marine haul-out and boatyard in Sitka is 1 year out from completion, although no ground has been broken yet. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has this report.
The city received 2 highly competitive bids for the project, according to municipal engineer Michael Harmon. Now the goal is to see how well costs for the winning bidder, Western Marine, align with design estimates. Harmon spoke to the board of the industrial park last week.
So I'm very antsy to get into that step to really feel like we can come back to you with much higher confidence in our overall approach. I'm still very confident in it, but I like to hear that from the contractor.
Sitka has just over $9 million in hand for the project from the sale of the former Sitka Community Hospital building and a $1 million grant from the Denali Commission. This amount will buy a very basic facility, including a travel lift and washdown pads, but it will take roughly $6 million more to add features like an expanded boatyard, restrooms, and office space. With such a tight budget, rising costs are a worry. Harmon told the board that bringing in a contractor at the design stage, technically called a construction manager at risk, means that the CMAR will bear significant responsibility for holding the line on expenses.
These contracts are set up so the construction's on actual cost. They have to prove up on their actual cost, all their receipts, their time, their labor, and then they get their markup on top of that. And then the third component that we locked in, and Sitka's kind of unique in this because we're trying to lock in as much as we can on these up front, is we listed out a whole bunch of general conditions like mobilizing your equipment here, getting office space for your crew. We had a whole list of general conditions that they locked in now, and they cannot change that either.
Harmon said the variables at this point boil down to materials and subcontractors. A consistent concern of the Industrial Park Board is the absence of electrical service to the boatyard work areas. With no wiggle room in the main funding package, Park Director Gary White said he's looking at doing it as a side project.
We've heard from this board that that's an important thing, and we really want to figure out how we can separate this project from that project, because if we end up going for something that's going to fit the waterfront, that could tie in NEPA and all kinds of other federal environmental stuff that would potentially drag out the waterfront development.
NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act, which requires an environmental assessment of federally funded projects. Consequently, White sought the board's approval to apply for non-federal funding to pay for electrical service. Actual construction of the boatyard and haulout is scheduled to begin this coming October, with final completion in March 2025. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Republican United States Senator Lisa Murkowski isn't ruling out leading her party to become an independent. She's become rather unpopular with Republicans in her home state, especially after she voted to convict Donald Trump at his second impeachment. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin has this report.
Murkowski told CNN that she wishes Republicans had a presidential nominee she could support.
I just regret that our party is seemingly becoming a party of Donald Trump.
Murkowski did not directly answer when asked if she would become an independent. She's previously said she won't vote for President Biden either. Murkowski beat a Trump-endorsed challenger in 2022. A recent poll shows she's far more popular among Alaska Democrats than among Republicans. For NPR News, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Two new policies regarding civil trespassing and public records requests are on the table on the Kenai Peninsula Borough after officials say one individual harassed borough employees and burdened others with excessive requests. As KDLL's Riley Board reports, the sponsor of the policies says they would only target extreme situations.
On Tuesday night, the Borough Assembly voted to introduce two ordinances related to public access to borough buildings and records. The policies follow concerns about one resident, who borough officials say harassed employees at multiple borough offices and made unreasonable records requests. Tammy Goja-Cockrell, who directs the 911 Dispatch Center in Soldotna, testified Tuesday night about the impact that harassment has had on the center's employees and functions.
There is no request for service or response by law enforcement, fire, or EMS. The calls are strictly intended to harass the staff. These calls are at times antagonistic, including name-calling, and threatening to have our jobs, also demanding physical access to the emergency response center where we live. At other times, the calls continue to tie up 911 professionals whose priority is to serve the members of our community who are calling with legitimate needs.
Goja-Cockrell told the assembly the individual would park outside the response center for prolonged periods, demand to know the full names of dispatchers, and make veiled threats. Borough Mayor Peter Michicki, who authored the ordinances, says the borough tries to be as open as possible to the public in all circumstances, but this one individual's behavior crossed a line.
But when you have someone that's waiting around in the bushes, filming female employees, looking in their cars, trying to identify who owns each vehicle by filming inside of it and then putting it online, at some point, this has to be reasonable.
Michicki says the ordinances would only apply in the most extreme of circumstances. The trespass ordinance would allow the mayor, or the official in charge of a particular borough building, to prohibit a person from entering a building by oral or written order if they threaten violence, interfere with orderly conduct of borough services, or commit a crime against a borough official. The trespass order could not exceed 24 months. The records ordinance requires all requests to go through the borough clerk's office, and if one individual's requests take up more than 5 hours of personnel time per month, they'll have to pay those personal costs. Records must be clearly described, and the clerk can deny a request if they deem the purpose to be harassment of borough employees.
This is going to affect likely one person, and 59,900 and whatever borough residents will not be negatively impacted. In fact, they'll be positively impacted.
Michicki says the individual's behavior has cost the borough money and time over the past several months. And he says while he hopes these policies never need to be used, they would give the borough the tools it needs in case a similar situation arises in the future. The Assembly will vote on both ordinances at its April 16th meeting. In Soldotna, I'm Riley Board.
Kenai Peninsula College recently unveiled an art exhibit spotlighting a medium not many people know about. KDLL's Hunter Morrison spoke with the artist who created the pieces and has this story.
Inside the college's Gary L. Freeberg Gallery, onlookers of the show, Cranial Pathways, will find about 20 pieces of art that resemble a mix of ceramic work and wax paintings. The unusual medium, known as encaustic or hot wax, allows an artist to manipulate beeswax, resin, and pigments by heating them with a small torch on a canvas. The art form's root word, caustic, means to burn in.
Encaustic medium is very old. It goes back to Egyptian days and was initially used as a boat repair. It's sturdy stuff.
This is Marion Nelson, the artist behind the pieces in the gallery. She says she discovered the encaustic medium by accident through a friend.
And then somebody got clever and added a little color to it, and well, that looks like fun, and went from there, and then it became part of Egyptian mummies, and they still exist. So, wax is not going to deteriorate. It just has to be protected from getting broken or kicked apart.
The gallery features creations of varying sizes, styles, and colors, most of which were made within the last few years. Before working on any encaustic pieces, Nelson must allow her studio to heat up. She says she's a night owl and sometimes works on her art until 2 or 3 in the morning.
I have often said the wax makes as many decisions or more than I do, or the heat or the movement. I mean, I am often not starting with anything in my head, and we'll just see what works out this time.
One thing that sets encaustic apart from other art forms is its overall fluidity. If you're unsatisfied with your work, you can always go back and change what's on the canvas. Nelson says one of her favorite pieces in the gallery is one she altered this way. Titled Walking, the large canvas is filled with rectangular shapes, some with lines that contour them. Nelson was unsure if she wanted to add more or less of these lines, and even asked friends for their opinions.
I obviously made the decision to put the lines in some that surrounds some of those shapes, and left it like that, and I'm glad I did.
Although the gallery consists mostly of Nelson's hot wax work, it features a number of her cold wax pieces, which do not require heat to create. Also on display is a mixed paper creation that has never been on view in a gallery setting. While the encaustic medium is more popular in art hubs like New York City or Seattle, Nelson hopes her display will help expand the Kenai Peninsula's artistic breadth. She says many Alaskans have never heard of encaustic art.
As a person said in a workshop that I gave at one point, I guess you're never really done. And I said, that is correct, because you can always heat it up and move things around. There isn't anything in the room, in the gallery here, outside of the cold wax pieces that I couldn't change right now if I wanted to.
Cranial Pathways will be on view through early May. The gallery is open Monday through Thursday, 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and Fridays, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. In Soldotna, I'm Hunter Morrison.
The U.S. consumer is generally satisfied with the present and not so sure about the future. I'm Nova Safa with the Marketplace Minute. The Consumer Confidence Index maintained by the Conference Board was essentially unchanged this month. Assessment of current conditions ticked up slightly between February and March. Short-term expectations soured further. Inflation remains a top concern. A container ship leaving the port of Baltimore overnight struck and destroyed a major bridge. Rescuers searched for survivors in the water. The destruction blocked the waterway in and out of the East Coast port. Two separate reports show home prices climbing about 6% in January compared to a year earlier. That price growth is considered around the historical average, according to the Federal Housing Finance Agency. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Tuesday. It is the 26th day of March, the year 2024. The sun rose today at 7:52. It will set again at 8:38, giving us 12 hours and 46 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 5 minutes compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 54 degrees, set in 1924, and our record low was 3 degrees, set in chilly 1975. Currently 41 degrees under fair skies. There are calm winds at the airport, and they have 10 full miles of visibility air travelers. Look for mostly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Southwest winds around 5 turning to the east. For tonight, a chance of rain and snow mainly after 5 a.m. as cloudy skies start to move in. Low of 25 overnight tonight with west winds to 10. And for tomorrow, mostly cloudy, 30% chance of rain early in the morning. Sunny skies are predicted for Thursday. We have an incoming tide. Our next high tide here on the east side will happen at 3:42 this afternoon and be 7.7 feet, followed by a low tide at 9:31 p.m. of 0.8 feet. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 4:10 this afternoon and be 13.5 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 10:13 p.m. of 1 foot. Mariners, here is your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles, southwest 15 becoming west 15 tonight and northwest 15 tomorrow, 7 foot seas coming down to 4 feet for tonight and tomorrow. Over in the Shelikof Strait, west 15 today, tonight, and tomorrow, 3 foot seas throughout the period. West 20 Wednesday night, seas to 3 feet, building to 6 feet on Thursday. Well, it is that time. If you have not filed for your permanent fund dividend, you need to do that soon. Applications are due by March 31st. If you're a paper applicant, you need to postmark it by the 31st. Online applications must be submitted by 11:59 p.m. Don't wait until everyone jams up in the at the same time. The Choose Respect March is coming up tomorrow. That's happening at 12 p.m. at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium's parking lot. Join the Choose Respect initiative to encourage the formation of healthy, respectful relationships and promote a culture of no tolerance for domestic and sexual violence. That's happening tomorrow, 12 p.m., at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium parking lot. You'll receive a free hat or water bottle while supplies last. For more information, call 907-486-6171. Meetings coming up in the Kodiak Island Borough include today's meeting of the Solid Waste Advisory Board. They're having a work session in the Kodiak Fisheries Research Center's conference room at 5:15 p.m. Also today, the Bayview Road Service Area Board Budget Public Hearing is happening at the Bayside Fire Hall. That's happening at 6 p.m. And on Thursday, the Assembly will be having a work session in the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. And tonight, the Kodiak City Council will be having a work session in the Kodiak Public Library's Multipurpose Room. Packets can be found on the appropriate websites, and all meetings are open to the public. The Kodiak Harvest Food Cooperative is having its annual meeting. That's happening Thursday at the Kodiak College. There will be a vendor market from 5 to 6 p.m., and the meeting will be conducted from 6 to 7. Light refreshments will be served. All are welcome, but you must be a member of the Kodiak Harvest Food Cooperative to vote in the Board of Directors election. Again, that's on Thursday. Whole thing starts at 5 with a vendor market, and the meeting starts at 6. And it's coming up, Isle Bells presenting March Gladness Concert Series, and the last in the series will be this Saturday. That's happening in the Auditorium Choral Pod at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium, 4 p.m. this next Saturday. Always lots of fun and sounds great.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.